and welcome to minute 46 of season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick, Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me on this lovely Monday morning in the beginning of September is Kurt Kenny, award-winning producer, director, writer, composer, filmmaker. He basically just does everything. You know, he doesn't need a staff. So welcome to the show, Kurt.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'm glad. It's you and I have more or less been in touch either via Facebook or Twitter or emails for years, and I'm glad I finally was able to get you on one of my shows. Start talking about it. You were actually very generous. You sent me some of your movies that I can actually watch them. So. I will publicly now thank you for that. That's great. and I gotta also say, and I've probably said this to you in the past or whatever, but one of the movies that you made is my all time favorite documentary. I've seen hundreds and hundreds of documentaries, and there isn't a documentary that I would say that I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but that I get so much out of than your movie Dear Zachary. I mean, it's, to me. Dana, I was talking about this with Dana Nachman in last season. Maybe it was in the green room. I don't remember where I discussed it with her, and she thinks I'm nuts that I've seen the movie like 6 times or 7 times. It maybe even more than you've seen it. Have you seen it that many times? Actually, you have.
I've had to put the whole thing together, and I've had to sit through a million screenings. Are you talking about? And then I remastered the whole film, a couple of years ago in HD. From the original thing, it was shot by shot. So yeah, I've seen it more than anyone on the planet, certainly.
Yeah, probably. Okay, but I've always admired the fact that you were able to take such a personal story and make a movie about it that could actually touch other people who don't know you and don't know the story. I mean, now I obviously know the story, but so
it's funny that you say that, Dana, because she I remember when she hired me to come in and collaborate with her on Bat Kid Begins. Mm-hmm. She really said, "Oh, I loved your editing." But then it's interesting though, because I thought, okay, she must have just watched Dear Zachary again recently. And no, she hadn't seen it since it first came out, because she said, "No, I refuse to watch it again because it's too upsetting."
Right. She told me that she's only seen it once.
I remember your editing from years ago, and I remember liking it, and so I want that on this movie. I'm like, okay.
Hey, why not? That means that you were able to put your stamp on people's minds, and that's not a simple thing to do.
I just thought she would have gone back and looked at it again before hiring me.
or at least not tell you that she didn't. All right, so we're actually here to talk about Die Hard. So we'll talk about Die Hard a little bit also. It's great talking about Dear Zachary. I don't know if you or I would want to do it minute by minute, but actually you lived it by minute by minute. So I think that's more than enough. But so we're here to talk about Die Hard. So minute 46 begins with shots ringing out and ends with Al getting information on a call. Mm-hmm. All right, so on Friday, we left off. John was on the top of the Nakatomi building. He was trying to call on Channel 9 to get some sort of, police operator, dispatcher to send someone out. And it didn't work. He was very upset at them. And apparently he needed, Carl and Fritz and Franco to actually help him out by shooting at him. the shots ring out. And, I mean, first of all, they have great pyrotechnics here. The way that the first of all, when I think of Carl, I think of him as a sharpshooter, but he always misses. He's never able to get John. Doesn't happen at all. John is first startled by the shots ringing out, and we see all these sparks flying around him from all of the various bullets hitting around him, and then he goes and jumps over a railing in order to stay away from getting hit. And at the exact same time, the both the dispatcher and her supervisor hear these shots ring out, and they both take off their earpieces because it rings very, very loudly for them. And they hear this screeching sound in their ears. And we actually hear them say, ow, and whoa, and things like that. So at this point, you know, Carl begins to move into position and is working his way towards McLean in order to try and shoot him. Just to remind everyone who might have forgotten, you know, McLean a few weeks ago actually killed Carl's brother, Tony. And so Carl is looking at this from a very personal perspective and wants to make sure that he's, you know, going to get John. And he finally, this is his first opportunity to do so. And at this point, McLean once again avoids the shots quite agilely. You know, you don't think of John McLean. I mean, he's not out of shape, but you also don't think of him as, you know, being very acrobatic and things like that. But Bruce Willis does a nice job of doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, as he jumps over the railing onto like a slanted part of the roof, and he slides down it. You know, if there was snow in California on this Christmas Eve, then, you know, he would be sledding down the side. You know, maybe they should just put that in post-production. You know, just a little bit of snow on the on that slanted part of the roof. And he, you know, as he's sliding down, there's like sparks on the roof also, which looks really funny the way that they do that. You know, and I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting, and you being both a director and an editor and, you know, all of your other hats, you probably noticed this also. I mean, in the first 8 seconds of this minute that we're watching, there are six cuts, you know, and, you know, would you, I mean, you've done six episodes of The Blacklist as a director, you know, are these type of cuts, you know, a director, I assume, has the power or has the final say in how it's edited, correct? And how movies and TV shows are edited.
Not necessarily in television, but in this movie, yes.
Okay, in movie. Okay, all right, okay, that's fair. I understand that. But, I mean, do you think that having six cuts in 8 seconds, is that considered normal?
For an action scene, sure. Yeah, I mean, or more, you know, it's whatever needs to happen for the rhythm and for the how it's coming together. So yeah, I mean it works great the way they have it. You're both between the kineticism of what's happening on the rooftop plus the cutting back and forth to the police dispatchers and everything. It's yeah, I mean that's what it needs.
So. Okay, all right, no, that's great. I mean, yeah. I'm a movie fan, so I watch these things, and I usually don't count.
The sparks you're talking about when he's sliding down, that's the gunfire that's missing him, that's hitting the building. I'm running the thing without sound here on just looking over that because you said
yeah you okay you're right sparks. you're right completely
yeah that's yeah. Carl shooting at him and missing
which again so. He's coming really close each time, you know.
Yeah,
you're right I you know, and we see the sign for Ralph's once again, which we talked about a few weeks ago. You know, the supermarket that's just over the bend. You know that, yep, you can see
the Ralph's logo. Yeah,
yeah, you actually see two of them.
Ralph's is my local shopping center here in Los Angeles too.
So. Well, how far are you from Century City?
I'm in sort of in Burbank, which is sort of the northern part of LA, but it's about, if traffic is kind, maybe 30 minutes. So,
oh, okay. Have you ever been to the Nakatomi Building / Century City Building?
Oh, yeah, I've had meetings there, yeah, because it's part of the, well, I guess now former 20th Century Fox lot, which is now the 20th Century lot. I don't know. I guess it's still the Fox lot. I don't know, because I know Disney bought it, and now everything says 20th Century on their stuff, right. But they don't have the word Fox anymore. But it's
20th Century Disney. Fox lot.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I remember when I first moved here going, wait a minute, is that the building from Die Hard? And they go, yeah, it's the building from Die Hard. And so you would always drive by and go, oh, that's the building from Die Hard. And then you drive that street so many times that you just stop noticing after a while. But I do remember the first time I ever had like a meeting in that building with an executive or something, a film executive, because it's, you know, Fox owns the building, so it's filled with their people. And I just remember going, oh my God, I'm going into the building. And it's so, I mean, it doesn't necessarily like look the same. Because I'm sure that was all sound stages and everything that they shot, you know, the floors upstairs, the lobby's the same, but yeah.
So, you didn't jump off with a, with a fire hose wrapped around your waist.
No, I was not that adventurous. The meeting I was there for didn't really call for that kind of response.
No, but you said that the lobby is the same? That really is the lobby that they film in?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, as I recall. Yeah, I mean, it's right there, so they would have used it. You know, there's no reason to rebuild it, as far as I know. But, yeah, I mean, honestly, I haven't been there in several years, so it's hard for me to remember specifically. But as far as I remember, yeah.
Okay, so I'll send you on a mission. The next time you're there, take a look and let us know. Is it the same lobby? You know, that type of thing. Right. So basically, you know, as he falls off of this slanted roof, he hits the railing, and it looks like he's hitting it pretty hard. You know, the velocity that he's falling in and stuff like that. But he still, you know, quickly gets a hold of himself, and he's able to turn around quite quickly and start running away. You know, to stay away from all the squibs and you know, pyrotechnics going off along the way to make it look more more thrilling for us to watch. You know, and then the shot goes back to the dispatchers, and we see that the supervisor she realizes that you know, something should be done, but she still doesn't seem overly concerned. You'd think that at this point they would know what it's, you know, what the sound of a gunshot might be. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting looking at that scene, particularly in today's world, of the fact that they don't take it very seriously. Whereas I think today you take that very seriously.
Right, post 9/11 for sure.
Yeah, or just not even 9/11 per se, just all the awful mass shootings that happen in this country now. It's something that you take seriously and you get right.
Yeah, for sure.
You know. So that's the thing. When I watched that scene, I'm like, really? You're kind of like, see if somebody can go by, as opposed to this is an incident.
Exactly. You
know, get people over there immediately.
Right.
And the fact that they take him seriously it's interesting. I remember seeing this. I saw this in the theater like the first week that it was out, back in 1988. And it's hard to remember because the world was so different then, but like,
and also you were 14, so it's not like, you know.
Yeah, I guess I would have been. Yeah.
Yeah, you and I are the same age, so.
Okay, yeah. Well, because my birthday's in October, though, so I would have.
Right. See, that I know from IMDb.
So I might have been, let's see.
You were still
I would probably.
You were 14, no, going on 15.
That's right, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, you're right.
I did the math for you, Kurt.
I actually saw this for the first time with Andrew from Dear Zachary.
We
saw it together. At the Century Town and Country in San Jose, which doesn't exist anymore. They bulldozed it and made Santana Row there. But it's interesting to think back to that time. Like, would this, in the time that it was made, would that have seemed like a normal response? Or is that a movie thing that they're trying to, like, make it more difficult for the lead character that nobody believes him? You know?
I think it's a movie thing. I would assume that if someone called and said everything that he said last week, and everything that he's saying now, you gotta take it at least a little bit more seriously than getting a response. See if there's a black and white that can do a drive by. You know, actually, that's funny that they also say drive by at that point. You know, when they're talking about shooting. You know, that's. I wonder if the writer put that in there on purpose. You know, to make it sound also funnier.
It's also interesting looking at this this movie again too, just to remember. Because that was one thing I loved at the time is how wide the aspect ratio is. I mean, this is a real rectangle, right? I mean, this is, you know, I mean, just.
Yeah.
Because this is wider than most movies. And I love that because it was on the big screen. This was such a widescreen movie. And the lenses, I remember, because Jan de Bont, I believe, was the cinematographer on this.
Mm-hmm.
The like even in the shot of Bruce Willis when he falls against the railing and you look out there, just the way all the out of focus lights in the distance become these ovals, I love what the lenses do to the lights. That's kind of a feature throughout this film of the way the lenses treat the things that are out of focus in the background as well too, is just the way the glass treats it, that they become these like ovals, because oftentimes you see when you're throwing lights out of focus in the distance, they'll become like a circle. But in this case, on these lenses, they become like an oval, which I always thought was so cool. And another thing I remember.
Wait, and that's connected to the aspect ratio? See, I don't know enough about this stuff. That's why I'm glad that you're teaching me about this and teaching everyone who's listening about this. I never even thought about the fact. So, I mean, it's because of the aspect ratio that when you're looking at lights from afar, they're going to look like just ovals as opposed to.
Well, it's a feature of this particular lens. These are, I'm sure, Panavision lenses probably, but because what this, the way this kind of film was shot back in the day is that the Panavision lens would squeeze the image like because the film itself was, say, more of a rectangle, like, you know, closer to, you know, most movies are 1.85 or whatever, so, and this is much wider, so to get the most out of the film, what they would do is they would take the lens would, you know, be shooting for this aspect ratio we're watching, but then it would squeeze the image down from right to left, you know, horizontally, so everyone would like look really thin and tall, pancake-ish, and on the image in order to fill the 35 frame, and then when they project it, the lens unsqueezes it again to make it, you know, all wide and rectangular. And so that's kind of, I think, a feature of that. Although weirdly, you would think if that were happening that they would go ovalish the other way, but they don't. So it's just a feature of this particular lens I just happen to like a lot. And it's a look that I remember from that era that you don't see as much anymore. And that I really always liked. And another thing I really do remember very well from this is you see this movie in the theater and like, oh, it's amazing. And around that time, of course, VHS was all we had, right? To watch.
And then it had pan and scan.
Like, oh man, I can't wait for Die Hard to come out on VHS so I can see it again. And then you get it, and you are literally seeing half the frame. Correct. Because it was a 4:3 image. And so there was no, you never had anywhere near the same experience with Die Hard on home video because you could only see half the image. That's why I remember in like 1990 or so, I finally got a Laserdisc player. And those were the only ones that had letterboxed editions of things where you could actually see the whole image with the black bars on the top and bottom. Right. Die Hard was one of the first movies I bought because I wanted to be able to see it again, you know, way with the actual image, you know, and not just see like half the image with half of it chopped off and then panning back and forth across this widescreen image, which pan and scan was a particularly terrible idea of the VHS era.
Yeah, no, I but, remember.
But this movie, I remember being one of the this movie and Born on the 4th of July were two that I remember movies I loved from that era that just did not work on VHS because you could only see half the image, and right. And same with actually Chinatown too. Chinatown is almost this wide as well.
Okay.
And yeah, so it's. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what numeric aspect ratio this is, but this is, you know, really wide, you know, compared to most movies. So anyway, just a little.
Right. No, that's great. Thank you. I mean, I remember that on one of the DVD sets that I bought of Die Hard, so they had a special feature where they showed the whole idea of pan and scan as opposed to watching it in widescreen. And, you know, not being someone who looks at the technical aspects of a movie like you do, you know, for me, it bothered me watching it on TV screen, but I was still glad to be able to watch it again. You know, it didn't make sure as much of a difference from that perspective. But once I saw this DVD feature explaining to me the difference between pan and scan, you know, that the idea that they zoom in and then they, you know, they move from left to right and stuff like that. I remember on this feature, they showed the scene where where they're opening the vault. I think that's what it is. And you see the difference, and it just blew my mind how very different watching something in pan and scan and watching something like this was. And, you know, but now we don't have to worry about that anymore because now we just complain that we have these black bars on our screens. You know, that's it.
but interesting, because with this movie, I remember seeing it for the first time in the theater and going, oh, wow, you know, that's amazing. And then seeing it later on VHS and going, huh, that's different. Whereas there were some movies, I remember both Chinatown and Jaws, like, are two that come to mind that are widescreen, that the first time I ever saw them was on VHS.
I don't think I would be very upset at your parents if they took you to see either of those in the theater, you know.
true. But that's the interesting thing is because for years I had only ever seen Chinatown and Jaws on VHS. So when I finally got to see them, I don't remember if it was just the Letterboxd edition on Laserdisc or if I, you know, because I've now seen them both on the big screen many times at revival screenings. But when I remember seeing them for the first time going, that's why that shot is composed that way, because it would just be this weird, awkward frame that you would see on the VHS pan and scan. But then you see the whole thing, you go, oh, because it didn't make sense. Why is this guy weird in the frame like this? And then you go, oh, that's, we're only seeing the left half. Now I'm seeing the whole picture. Now I understand why it was composed that way. Wow. So that was kind of an outgrowth of growing up on VHS, is you would eventually see these movies and understand why what seemed like a very awkward composition on VHS was actually a very good composition. You could see the rest of the image.
Yeah. So, oh, wow. Interesting.
Close Encounters was another one that way, too, because that's very wide. I only ever saw that on VHS first, and then later you see that on the big screen, you go, oh, that's why it's composed that way. So, yeah.
That's so fascinating. That's great. Again, I never pay attention to these things, but when you point them out, it makes sense, you know. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I need to watch movies with people like you who can point them out as I'm watching it. And they're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. You know.
Well, yeah, and you can even see it in the background of, like, the shot with the dispatchers and the you know, when they're saying, hey, see if there's a black and white that can do a drive-by, that even the lights on the panel behind them kind of have this ovaly kind of thing going on.
Oh, you're right. As well, wow. And also on the Christmas tree, which is even closer, but it's still, you know, somewhat out of focus. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Very cool.
Yeah, just a feature of that particular glass, that lens that I happen to like, but yeah.
So. Have you ever used it in anything that you filmed?
No. No. Not that I'm aware of, no. We're never, I mean, they use Panavision lenses on Blacklist, but not, you know, they were never shooting this wide, and they were not shooting anamorphics. So.
No, but they're also shooting it 30 years later, so I'm assuming that they're using the same lenses.
Sony Venice, on Sony Venice digital cameras, with, I think they had the Panavision Primo set or something, but it's not anamorphic per se, it's just, you know, basically like 16x9 1/8 type thing is what they're doing with that. So
yeah. Okay. All right. So then the scene switches and we get a shot of a bunch of I guess you could say tasty goodies. You know,
Twinkies.
We see a bunch of Twinkies. We see some Hostess fruit pies. We see lemon and blackberry. We see a few other things out of focus. Can't really tell what exactly they are. We hear music in the background of Let It Snow. You know, let it snow, which is basically one of the main themes of this movie, which, you know, we will hear numerous times throughout the movie, even when we get to the credits. That is the first song that is played, you know, as Argyle is getting back into the limo and says, if this is their idea of Christmas, I got to be here for New Year's, you know, and then let it snow starts off there. So basically, yeah. we see all these Hostess cakes. So what do you know about Hostess cakes?
Oh, probably too much. I remember that. It's funny, interesting seeing this packaging from the 80s, because I remember that packaging. And I do not eat Twinkies regularly, I must say. But I must confess, I did buy a box of them just about a week ago.
To prepare really, for this.
because the new Minions movie just came out. And I remember, like, years ago they did a promotional tie-in with the Minions when the first Minions movie came out, where they packaged the Twinkies to look like the Minions, okay, with like the little Kevin, Bob, and Stuart things over them. I was hoping they were going to do that again this time. They did not. But I was actually going to my local, because I've developed an affinity for drive-in movie theaters, particularly since...
Since you made a documentary yet. About it. Yeah.
Well, I did. I renewed my experience with them during lockdown, during the pandemic, because that was the only movie theater that was open. And so now I just go back there a lot. So I was going to see the Minions movie at the drive-in. I thought, you know, I got to have Twinkies if I'm going to see the Minions at the drive-in. I just got to do it, you know, because the Minions look like Twinkies, and I don't know. So I did that, and that was its own thing. But they did not have the Minions packaging this time, which was disappointing to me.
But were they anyway, still tasty? There's nothing to do
with Die Hard. So everything to do with Twinkies and nothing to do with Die Hard. But,
you know. That's fine. That's okay. But were they still tasty for you?
Oh, very much, yes. Right. Yeah, so, I just finished the box yesterday, and I'm sure I will not buy another one for like 5 years. But
until the next Minion movie comes out. which
pretty much.
which based on you know how well it has done you know in the theaters, it probably will not take 5 years for another one to come out.
Well, from what I understand, this one's been done for a couple of years, but they were holding it because of just like with Top Gun, they were holding it because they wanted to release it when theaters were in full swing again. So, yeah, so I think it was actually only supposed to be 5 years between Minions movies, not seven. But but oh well,
who knows? Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. So, I mean, personally, Hostess food, it's not kosher, so I haven't had any of them. I've had you know, I guess you could say replicas. Or, you know, I've had the kosher versions of them, and kosher Twinkies are great. And I always love the fruit pies also, especially the apple ones, which we'll see in a few seconds when they pan up, but we don't get to see that yet. So Hostess, do you know what year the brand Hostess actually debuted?
No, I do not.
What would you guess? How many years? Give a guess.
When I would guess sometime in the 1970s, but I could be wrong.
Okay, 1919.
Really? Wow. Yes. Okay.
Dang. Yes. They started out with the Hostess cupcakes in 1919, and the Twinkies only were produced in 1930. Okay.
Wow. Because so, I remember they went out of business for a little while too, and then they
were out of business like recently, between I think 2009. Mm-hmm. 2012, something like that. That it, yeah. Right, 2009 to 2012, they didn't have it, and then it came back in 2013. Mm-hmm. But
makes sense.
So, I mean, I can understand why you would think that it was created in the 70s and 80s, because in the 70s and 80s, they would have lots of ads in comic books. Mm-hmm. Okay, they would have all these comic book advertisements. They have full page ads. You know, they did in DC and Marvel and Harvey and Archie Comics and Gold Key Comics, that they would actually have, you know, the writers and artists of those comics actually would do the artwork on this. They would have some sort of, you know, either some major character, whether it was a hero or a villain, you know, trying to, you know, get the other to eat Hostess products. You know, for instance, they would have, you know, the superhero typically trying to defeat a villain by distracting them or bribing them with Hostess products or things like that. And then they would have like things with maybe the Joker or the Penguin, and they would fail to do the same thing by trying to distract Batman and Robin with the whole thing. I mean, I was a big comic book fan back in the 70s and 80s. So I you know, when I came across this bit of trivia, it you know, reminded me of what things were like back then with those full page ads and stuff like that. So yeah. Now, do you remember any of the mascots from Hostess?
Mainly just the Twinkie Cowboy.
Do you remember what his name was?
Twinkie the Kid?
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So the most recognized mascot is Twinkie the Kid, which is a Twinkie dressed like a Wrangler who acts like a person. Other mascots that they had were known as Big Wheels, Captain Cupcake, Fruit Pie the Magician. That one I remember seeing things before. Happy Ho Ho, King Ding Dong, Chauncey Chocodile, Susie Q, and Chipper Brownie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it brings back a lot of memories. So the Twinkie is a golden sponge cake with a creamy filling. Right. It was invented in 1930 by a man named James Alexander Dewar in Schiller Park, Illinois, where he actually had several machines that were used for making cream-filled strawberry shortcakes, and they weren't using them because there were no strawberries. It was not strawberry season, so he decided to use banana cream instead. And he put that inside the white cake and called it a Twinkie. And that quickly became very popular. But during World War II, there was bananas were being rationed. So he had to think of something else to be able to put inside. So somehow he came up with the idea that he was going to switch to vanilla cream. And I guess you could say the rest is history, because once that happened, nobody wanted the banana flavor anymore. They tried bringing back the banana flavor a few times, and it just never worked. People didn't want it. They only want the, you know, they only wanted the cream-filled ones.
Well, actually, I did find that this summer they did bring back the banana briefly, and that's the one version that they're doing with Dominion's artwork on it right now, because the Minions love bananas, so because they're always banana, banana, right. You know, so.
Okay.
So this summer they have a banana one back, I guess, briefly, but I didn't find it in the shopping center where I was, because I would have gotten I would have gotten that version just for the artwork of the Minions.
Have you tasted the banana flavor? Is it, or you just happen? No. Okay. No, yeah, I was wondering I was wondering if it's more, you know, if it's tastier, who knows? Right. Can you think of any other movies besides Die Hard that reference Twinkies?
Ghostbusters.
That's right. sure. That's right. That's where Egon, you know, talks about the speculated level of psychokinetic energy and uses a Twinkie to represent the normal level of such energy in New York. And then he says, based on a recent sample, the Twinkie representing New York would be over 35 feet long and weigh approximately 600 pounds. To which Winston says, that's a big Twinkie.
Yep.
So yeah, I found like a whole bunch of references. I'll just mention a few of them. The movie The Deer Hunter has you know, someone dipping a Twinkie in mustard. I don't know. That doesn't sound very tasty, but apparently for them it's in the movie The Jerk with Steve Martin. So he said that his favorite meal is tuna fish salad on white bread with mayonnaise and a couple of Twinkies.
I remember that now.
Okay.
I remember that. I was like, here, Naven, have a Twinkie.
There you go.
Yes.
The movie UHF with Weird Al Yankovic, he made a Twinkie wiener sandwich. He takes a hot dog and put it inside of the Twinkie and put the easy cheese on top for him to have that. In the movie Benny and June with one of the characters grabs two Twinkies and uses them as dance shoes in a diner, similar to what we saw Robert Downey Jr. do that in Chaplin, and I think also Billy Crystal did it in Mr. Saturday Night. I'm sorry?
It comes from, yeah.
Yeah. Hmm? No, what did you say?
Oh, Charlie Chaplin himself did that, and it was a fork and a couple of things in his silence. That's where it comes from, yeah.
Exactly, of course. And there's also a Seinfeld episode, the episode The Big Salad, where Jerry refers to Newman as being a mystery wrapped up in a Twinkie. So, yeah, I mean, I found a whole bunch more. I have, like, another two pages of references. I think we're just going to skip those. You know, I think we've done the big ones from the 70s and 80s. We won't go into more modern versions of them. But there's also the idea of a Twinkie defense. Have you ever heard of that in law?
Oh, yeah.
It's a legal defense. It's not a recognized legal defense, but it's a catch-all term used by reporters during their coverage of the trial of defendant Dan White for the murders of San Francisco City Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone. So White's defense was that he suffered diminished capacity as a result of his depression. His change in diet from healthy food to Twinkies and other sugary foods was said to be a symptom of his depression. Contrary to common belief, White's attorneys did not argue that the Twinkies were the cause of White's actions, but that their consumption was symptomatic of the underlying depression. So, you know, we've all heard of the Twinkie defense, but now we know where it's from. They also claim that Twinkies have an infinite shelf life. You know, that's one of the myths, but it's apparently not true. But that's just an urban legend that claims it. But it has to do – the urban legend claims that because of all of the, you know, chemicals that they use to produce this. And, so that's pretty much all we have to say about Twinkies. I think we've said enough about Twinkies.
Yeah, what I do like is here that they're being used to kind of flip the stereotype of the police officer, because the stereotype is always like the guy says at the counter in a moment here, don't you guys just like donuts? Or I thought you guys just ate donuts. And then he says, it's for my wife. She's pregnant. And the guy doesn't believe him.
Yeah.
But it's a nice way to both flip the stereotype of the police officer at the same time as giving story information that his wife is pregnant, which is going to come up later when he talks with John McClane and everything. So it's a really nice character introduction, I think. So
yeah, for sure. You know. And especially since, you know, Twinkies come up later also. So we established the fact that he likes Twinkies, because I don't really believe him that it's for his wife, but that's a separate issue. But
But it does bring up the whole subject of family, which he's going to discuss with John McClane later. So
yes, for sure. Yeah. I mean,
that's the good part is, like, it's not just a throwaway moment of we're meeting the character. It's like they're giving you something that's going to be used later. So.
Yes, this movie does that very often. There's so many things that are referenced at one point that come up later, and you don't expect them to come up at all. And this is another great example of that. I mean, you have there are 9 Twinkies on the shelf here that we see, and he has 2 in his hand, and he grabs 4 more. So, you know, he's carrying 6 bags of Twinkies, because I think there's 2 in each. So he's basically got 12 Twinkies. He's got a dozen Twinkies that he's taken to. You'd think he would have taken like a little hand cart or something like that, hand basket, if he knows he's taking so many, because he just like piles them up, you know, in his hand. You know, it's the type of thing that you do when you go somewhere and you don't expect to take more. You know, it's just something I'm just going to take one. And like, oh, well, if I'm already taking one, you know, I might as well just take 6. You know,
kind of question I can see an actor asking. Why wouldn't I just have a hand cart? Well, because it's a cooler image. You look at the thing. Yeah, but would I do that?
So you think that Reginald Hill Johnson asked John McTiernan like that thing? Is that what you're saying?
Huh?
I said, so you think that Reginald Hill Johnson asked John McTiernan that question?
I don't know. He might have said, well, why wouldn't I have, you know, if I knew I was buying all these? It's like, well, you just decided right then and there. You just saw them on the rack. You weren't intending to, but, you know, maybe that's what it is.
So you're saying as a director, you need to be quick on your feet and know how to give a quick answer to these type of things, as opposed to having to think
about it. Or you can be adaptable and say, well, okay, the cart's not such a bad idea. Let's do that. But, you know, so you can, it's a question of, you know, just making that call. I mean, you shouldn't be wedded to the idea that he's got to carry the Twinkies. But then also, if you've got the cart, you got to deal with it over at the counter too. Like, where are you going to put the cart? Where does it sit? Do you have to walk? Because you don't want to have a bunch of extraneous movements.
Right. Okay. There is something to that also. Very true. Very true. Yeah. See, I don't think about those things. I think about why is he carrying a stack?
Props can be a nightmare. Just with on the Blacklist was always like prop hell. The people would always have 6 million gadgets, and you got to figure out what to do with them, and they would take forever, and you have to jump cut the scene later. And it's, yeah. So anyway.
Hey, why
not? So yeah, I'm glad he didn't go for the hand card personally, because it's just one more thing to have to put down.
Okay, that makes sense. No, but also it's nice to see him walking with you know, trying to make sure that something doesn't fall, you know, as he's walking. You know, that would have really been a nightmare if as he's walking, you know, I wonder how many times they had to you know, how many takes they had to make, you know, before that he didn't drop them all, you know, as he's walking by, you know, and carrying them over to the counter. And so the guy at the cashier. So it's an actor named Kip Waldo, who was born in 1953. He unfortunately passed away this past November at the age of 68. Mm-hmm. He only has 7 movie credits, and most of them are very small roles. And he has 1 TV credit, and that's in an after-school special. Okay. Hmm. So you, like me, probably, you know, grew up with all those after-school specials. You know, I was like looking them up to see just, you know, you remember the whole idea of an after-school special is, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Right. So basically, it had a 25-year run on ABC, okay, from October 1972 to January 1997. They would have short anthology-type shows that would be on either in the late afternoon or the weekends, and most of these episodes were dramatically presented situations, quite often very controversial subjects, you know, for children and teenagers to be able to try and get an idea, you know, to have to deal with these special episodes type of things. You know, it won 51 daytime Emmys over the 25 years that it ran. You know, and when if you look at the list, I'm not going to go through the whole list now, because again, it's 25 years of shows. I mean, most seasons had like 6 or 7 episodes, something like that, but that's still a very large amount. But a lot of actors, well-known actors that we know, were in a whole bunch of these type of things. So I'll just give another an example. In the second season, so there was an episode called Rookie of the Year, where you had an 11-year-old girl played by Jodie Foster, who encountered opposition when she wanted to join her brother's Little League baseball team, which was in 1972. That was the year when girls were first allowed to be in Little League teams. So they would have, I mean, that's not a controversial topic, but they would have topics about, teen pregnancy, about, premarital sex and drugs and, all the things that, all the fun things that kids like to do in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I guess,
mm-hmm.
which probably hasn't changed much since then. Or actually, we know it hasn't, even though we would like to believe that it has, It's always nice to believe that we're living in a more innocent world than we grew up in, but unfortunately, that's probably not true.
No.
But so they had all of these after school specials. So he was in one called The Gambler. So I mean, I didn't look up what his what he actually did in that role, but my assumption is it was also a very small role based on everything else that he's done. According to IMDb. So also, if you look around the cash register and stuff like that, they have some interesting things. There's a little sign where, well, actually, first of all, as you mentioned earlier, so when Al comes up to the counter and brings all his Twinkies, so the cashier then says to him, "I just thought you guys ate donuts." So do you know where the myth comes from that cops only eat donuts?
Well, I just think back in the day, the donut shop was just a convenient place for them to hang out. and I mean, there aren't as many donut shops anymore. So now there's like Starbucks and things, so that's but back in the day, I think there were a lot more donut shops than there are now.
Okay, well, so. you are completely correct, but it's a little more than that. It's the idea that at the end of shift, most cops would have to go somewhere to write up their reports. So they, if they're doing it in the middle of the night, so they would then find, a little coffee shop where they would have donut shops that were open all night. And, it doesn't cost very much money to buy a donut. And also, if you go to a diner, you have to wait and sit for your order to be ready and stuff like that. This was, right. I guess, considered more fast food at the time. That was seriously fast food. You just go into Dunkin' Donuts and you say, "Okay, I want that," and it's right there. And you can sit and wait. So that's where this myth came from. And there was also the idea that cops didn't want to go places where they would be offered things for free. So they would go to a relatively inexpensive place so that they wouldn't have to worry about that. They wouldn't feel the need to say, "Okay, I'll save $5. Instead, I'll save, 25 cents on the donut. But if someone's offering, they're not going to offer them free. They'll say, "I can still pay the quarter for the donuts," or whatever it was at the time. So at this point, then Al responds and laughs. And he doesn't laugh very convincingly, because then he says, "They're for my wife." And so the cashier goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "She's pregnant." "Yeah." Then he goes, "Bag it." Meaning, stop bothering me with this. You got me. I'm buying it for myself. And that's it. And then if you look on the side of the counter. So first of all, we know that this is the AM/PM. It's like a 7-Eleven type store that's open 24 hours a day. But you can see that when he gives the change to Al, so Al takes the change and puts it like in a little charity box on the side there, donation box. And there's a little sign right next to it that says, "Every 50 cents helps to keep a kid off drugs." And this sparked something in me. I said, this sounds so familiar. I was trying. So I did a search online and I was able to find that this is the part of one of the slogans from an educational program from the 80s that was known as DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education.
I remember that.
Yeah. And when I looked after that, finding that, I looked at the sign, you can actually see the words DARE on there. Mm-hmm. You can see that it's that really is what it's from. You know, it wasn't that it was just my imagination trying to find it. So the program was actually developed in 1983, along with the chief of police in L.A., Daryl Gates, along with the superintendent of the L.A. School District, Harry Handler. And the idea was to get kids to start talking about drug abuse and, you know, try to find ways for them to talk about it and not get into, you know, not get into drugs and alcohol. They would have all these lectures to students about the harmful consequences and things like that. You know, what you should do in order to refuse drugs, you know, just say no and things like that. So I thought that's great, you know, being able to just capture, you know, because as now I understand why, but nothing in the background is in focus. I mean, even if you look, it's because of the aspect ratio. If you look at all the posters,
that's the f-stop is just the you have a low f-stop of like a, you shoot everything at like a 2.8 or something like that, and it'll, you know, throw everything but like one plane out of focus. But it's the glass that they're using that makes the background, when it's out of focus, do certain things that it wouldn't on other lenses. But to get something out of focus, if you want to make sure like that only one thing in the frame is in focus and everything else is out of focus, that's when you use lower numbers on the f-stop, you know, go down to like f2, 2.8, you know, 3.2, something like that. Uh-huh. I do that a lot when shooting interviews with people, is because you really want like the person's face to be crisp and everything else to fall off in the background. So you try to, you know, shoot at the lowest stop possible. The problem being, of course, when you do that people, if they start moving around and everything in their chair, then you have to constantly keep refocusing because the smallest move will put them out of focus. but I feel it's best for visually to, you know, keep the audience's focus on one thing. It's just more pleasing, I think.
Right.
But, you know, if you shoot really high f-stop numbers, things are in focus. But
right. No, I find it very interesting that despite that, we can still see the words on the thing for Dare. You know, because it's even
sure.
Because like all the stuff on the shelves are all out of focus, but here it's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, so that's very interesting. So he puts the money into the charity box, and then
That's because the sign is right next to
Al.
Al, right. who's in focus. So because it's right, it's small in the frame, but it's right next to him, so it's part of what's being chosen and selected right. for focus.
Right. Okay. And then you know, you can see that Al feels quite embarrassed about this whole situation, the way that he's walking past the cashier. You know, he knows he's been caught. His wife is pregnant. Okay. But these Twinkies are not for his wife. We know that. That's what it comes down to. Just by the body language, you know, and as he's walking towards the door. So we see a sign for it says 99 cents. Make your own milkshake. And then right next to that is a soft ice cream dispenser for 69 cents, which, you know, nowadays it would probably be a few dollars worth each of those.
Yeah.
You know, and inflation over the last 34 years, you'll never be able to make your own milkshake for 99 cents.
Yeah, it's a bit different.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I wonder if they even let people make their own milkshakes at this point, or you have to have the, you know, the cashier do it for you. Yeah.
I don't know. They still have AM/PM mini marts around. I've never really looked at, I go there to get gas and that's it. So I don't really look at what they offer in the shop, but the chain itself is still in existence.
Right.
So.
Okay. Makes sense. And then he's walking out of the store and he gets a call on his radio. And we hear a woman on the radio saying, dispatch to 8 Lincoln 30, over. So he takes his microphone and responds, this is 8 Lincoln 30, come on in, over. And then she says, investigate a code 2 at Nakatomi Plaza, Century City. Okay. Now, do you have any idea what a code 2 is?
No.
Okay. So I looked it up, and the only thing it means, urgent. Code 2 means urgent, using lights and sirens. But he's not supposed to go with lights and sirens. So I'm a little confused about that reference as why they would say that. But I don't know. It's just
they might not have done as much research as you did. Maybe I don't know.
Apparently not. they knew that you know they didn't know that 34 years from now someone was going to be doing a minute by minute podcast analyze of Die Hard and analyze the fact that they call it a code 2. Who knows? there's also something written on the window which is backwards. We can't really see what it says, you know, because it's from the outside, but. There is no word that I could figure out that it's Y-E-N-I-K-O-M-S-H-I-A-N. I have absolutely no idea what language that's in, but it just doesn't make any sense. It's Yannick.
Unless it's like the, I can have a guess because the word below it looks like it might be the end words of proprietor. So it's probably the name of the proprietor of the shop.
Oh, okay. That would make sense because so I couldn't figure like out what that name was.
So, you know, sometimes outside a gas station, they'll have like so-and-so proprietor outside. So
that actually explains a lot.
Gas station proprietor. And my guess is usually with those kind of things, you usually like make it a name of a friend of yours or somebody in the crew just to make a joke or something like that. So it's probably the last name of somebody they knew that they made as the proprietor of the shop.
Right. Probably not someone in the production of the movie because that is a name that would definitely stand out.
I mean, sometimes like even the people within the art department or something like that, they'll, you know, just name it after somebody who's working with them in the art department. No one would like know per se or something like that, but somebody who worked on the film or something.
So. Right. We've had that in this movie. And also I had it in Planes, Trains, Automobiles. There were things where, you know, you would find names of people that are part of the production. You know, we'll have that in the next few weeks also. There's a few of those also.
Like, you know, they do, like, I remember like that's something the Blacklist Art Department would do sometimes too. Like there was in one of the episodes I did, there was a pretzel cart that James Spader gets arrested next to. It was like season 6, episode 2. And Bradley Schmidt, who was the art director who was creating it. I think he called he painted on the thing Schmidt's Pretzels or something like that. Yeah, I just remember.
Okay,
I remember
makes sense. His name.
Thing. I was like, okay, cool.
Makes sense. So, I remember I once was at a discussion with a director from the movie. Have you ever seen the movie The Believer from 2001? It was
no, I haven't.
It was about a neo-Nazi who turns out he was actually Jewish. And it's sort of based on something that really happened. And so Henry Bean was the director of that. And I remember that he said in this discussion that I was present on, you know, someone asked him, you know, because he has a small little role in the movie. And he said that everyone on they needed a role for this guy who gets assassinated, you know. So they basically, everyone said that they should have the director do it because they want to be able to watch on screen the director getting his head blown off. Yeah. You know, so he had a small little, small little role there with that. So, yeah. I've known for a long time that you know, directors and other production people like to throw in little funny things about themselves and others that they know inside of movies. And, you know, as he's responding to the call, that's pretty much how this minute ends. So is there anything else you wanted to say about this minute?
No, I think we're good.
Yeah, I think we did a fine job with this minute. So the script has a few little minor discrepancies, not that many, but there's a few. First of all, they talk about the fact that for some reason the Carl is shooting with tracer bullets. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with what a tracer bullet is. A tracer bullet is usually when you're shooting at night, so you have every fifth bullet, you know, usually from a machine gun. I know this from when I was in the Army, in the Israeli Army 30 years ago. So every fifth bullet or something was a tracer so that you can see basically what direction you're shooting in. Okay. in the script, it makes sense that he would be using tracer bullets, but you know, why would they actually think to take tracer bullets, you know, when they're going to, you know, hijack a building, take hostages? You know, it's not something that, that so someone probably pointed out and told him, okay, you know, maybe you shouldn't, you know, maybe you don't need to have it in the movie itself. You know, they did the pyrotechnics well enough that there are enough sparks around there. Then it mentions that the dispatcher looks critically at the supervisor in sudden silence after the shots are ring out. And then the supervisor says, have a black and white do a drive-by. Then it also mentions that there's not an AMPM. It mentions the 7-Eleven and that there are actually three different employees in there. But again, these are all minor things. It's nothing, nothing really. But I like the way that they describe Al the first time that we see him. It says, the customer is Powell, young for a police veteran, old for the rest of the world. Okay, but, you know, he's neither. So, you know, but they still have the whole, you know, mention of the donuts and stuff like that. And then he goes, they're for my wife. She's pregnant. If I knew she was going to eat a dozen at one shot, I would have bought stock in the company. You know, so that actually makes it sound as if he's being more sincere as to why he's, you know, getting it. Because there isn't the whole back and forth between him and the cashier about the whole thing. And the other difference is that he's not 8 Lincoln 30, he's 1 Adam 10, which doesn't really make a difference. But that reminded me of Adam 12, you know, which was a TV show, which they I think it was from the 60s. I remember watching it on reruns as a kid. Mm. You know, it was like a police show called Adam 12. So okay. I wonder if that was part of the reason why, you know, he decided to call it Adam 10. And then, you know, they decided just to change that so it doesn't sound the same. So who knows? You never, these are things that, you know, you can just guess about. And, you know, we'll never know if we're right or wrong unless someone, you know, who's listening to this knows the truth and will let us know. Who knows?
Yeah.
Right.
Indeed.
Yeah, exactly. So every Monday we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guests will tell me their top five Die Hard doppelganger movies. So Kurt, you got a list for us? Why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Oh, as far as like favorite like action movies then, or
you
or
can do favorite action movies. That's fine too. Go ahead.
No, but what's the theme is supposed to be?
It's usually Die Hard is a movie that created a new type of genre. It's like one man against a whole bunch of others. You know,
a whole bunch of knockoffs of this at the time. There was, you know, Die Hard on a bus with Speed and Die Hard on a plane with Passenger 57.
Exactly.
Was,
That's the idea.
Or Air Force One was that, you know, it was kind of Die Hard on a plane with the president.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the idea.
I don't know that any of the knockoffs really did a lot for me. I mean, Speed I enjoyed. And Air Force One certainly has its moments. But as far as like, I don't know, like favorite like action movies, I mean, my favorite of all time is Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, that's never been topped in my opinion. But as far as like, I don't know, it's, you know, like one man against everyone's after him, like, you know, sort of thing. I mean, I don't know if Minority Report falls into this category or not, but that's one of my favorites too.
Okay, that can be there.
Because that's like one guy who's being, you know.
Okay, no, you know, that's fair. Yeah.
I mean, he's not trapped in the physical space though.
Right.
You know, North by Northwest comes to mind too. That's not, it's more of a thriller than an action movie, but yeah, as far as one person being trapped in like a physical space and, I don't know. This movie's kind of the tops there. I think.
Oh, for sure, it's the tops. That's not, that. There's no question about that. The idea is if you can think of any others that are similar, that you would, you know, that you enjoyed.
Well, I mean, another one that comes to mind, but it's, you know, I guess it's more Innocent Man Wrongly Accused, but it is one guy being hounded by everybody's the fugitive too. That one was great. Yeah, it's. I mean, because like I said, there were a lot of knockoffs, but I didn't really like them that much, except for Speed. So I don't have a huge list in this regard, unfortunately. But But
right. Okay. That's fair. No problem. Yeah.
Okay.
Not a problem. All right. Do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you if they're interested, if they're looking for a director? Sure.
My website is just myname.com. So, KURTKUENNE.com. And there's a button for contact on there and there's an email there too. So.
All right. Great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for a movie or a minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook, or you can go to my website. So Kurt, you feel like coming back again tomorrow and, maybe talking a little less about food.
Let's do it. I don't think there's any food in the next minute.
So no, that's why. So. That's why. We'll have to find something else to talk about tomorrow. How's that? Without food.
Sounds good.
All right, great. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.